Welcome to another episode of On the Issues with Alon Ben-Mir. Today's guest is Fatou Balde, a survivor of female genital mutilation, or FGM, and a gender justice specialist with an extensive experience in gender health and development. Over the past decade, she has been a leading advocate and contributor to knowledge on women's rights and the eradication of entrenched gender norms and practices, including eradication of FGM in the Gambia and the UK. In this episode, Alon and Fatou discuss the challenges from local communities in combating female genital mutilation, the proposed repeal of the Gambia's FGM ban and its consequences, and how to break the culture of silence around FGM and educate women about the effects that female genital mutilation has on their bodies.
So my question was, you know, now that you have went back to Gambia after your studies in England and you formed the organization that is based going about 5 years ago, you said. So my question is, do you encounter any resistance or any objection from the government itself in your effort to promote the prevention of FGM?
So in the Gambia, we don't necessarily face challenges from the government with regards to the work we do. Some of the challenge that we actually encounter is from the communities, because what we are challenging and fighting against is a socio-cultural norm that is very much normalized at our community level. So when you go to these communities, they are the ones that are resistant to change, but we are not having challenges directly from the government.
And so now that the communities are objecting because of tradition, because it's culture, and that is, I'm sure, you know, whereas you can, the government, which is, in this case, would have been much difficult to fight against, but then you have the community. And so obviously the tools to deal with the resistance of the community are different. So what sort of approach are you taking in order to convince the elders, so to speak, those who want to maintain the culture, want to maintain the practice, the terrible practice? What efforts are you doing in that direction to change the minds and the heart of the community?
So female genital mutilation, as you know, it's a deeply rooted practice that has been happening in many practicing communities and countries for centuries, and these are practices are believed to be helpful and advantageous to women and communities in general. These are the strong beliefs that practicing communities hold. So one of the things that we do at our organization is that we take our approach to the communities. We very much work on a community-led approach. First, we would go to our community and try to understand what are the reasons behind them continuing this practice, despite a lot of interventions to stop and for them to understand how it impacts them. So for instance, if a community tells us that they believe this is a requirement of Islam, we know that the intervention we use then is to engage religious leaders that know that FGM is not an Islamic obligation, to go to these communities and to engage them. And we also complement that with going with healthcare professionals who have seen women who've had FGM and how the practice affects their health, especially during pregnancy, during childbirth, so that they are able to go back to these communities and talk to them and give the right information to women and girls and the community in general. Because often what we seem to find is that when you go to communities and tell them FGM is harmful, a lot of them will tell you that it doesn't harm me. I've had FGM, my grandmother has had it, my aunties and everybody. And what you find is that in communities where FGM prevalence is high, even when women experience complications, they do not associate it to the practice. They actually believe that that is part of being a woman, because that challenge is normalized in that community. So women tend to accept that as being a woman rather than as a result of having undergone FGM. So part of our outreach activities is targeting education, behavioral change, and confronting those harmful norms that actually drive the practice of FGM.
So you have here basically three kind of resistance. One is the those who claim it's a tradition, they use Islam as the backup. That is, from their perspective, Islam ordained that this should be the case, which is obviously that's not the case, because from our experience in various Arab countries and other places where this practice is done routinely, they resort to Islam when they cannot explain it on any other level. So they resort to religion. So when God said so, then that's what they have to do. Then they have to obey, which isn't the case under any circumstance. So let's begin with the resistance of those who claim that Islam demands that. So you mentioned, how do you encounter those who make this argument to begin with?
Thank you again. In fact, in the Gambia, one of the biggest challenge that we have is religious leaders who have been countering the efforts that civil society, women-led organizations have been doing to engage communities and to eradicate female genital mutilation, because these religious leaders are going back to the communities and reinforcing that myth and misconception that FGM is a religious obligation. Unfortunately, in the Gambia, we have a very high illiteracy rate. A lot of women are not educated. A lot of women do not read the Quran or the religious scripts, or English for that matter. And we rely on religious leaders and men to interpret what is in this religious script. And they manipulate that to give the wrong information to communities. So when you go to a community with high illiteracy rate and you give them misinformation, that is how you fuel the practice to continue. So for our religious leaders, fortunately for us, we have some on our side who, like you've rightfully pointed out, who are also coming out and saying this is not an Islamic obligation, because we know other countries with high Muslim prevalence who do not practice FGM. We know that nobody can show us in the Quran where it says that FGM should be practiced. So we are having those conversations, and I think we've come a long way, because once upon a time, that narrative wasn't there. The narrative was always, this is Islamic. For me, as a survivor of FGM growing up, that was all I had. Nobody told me that FGM wasn't a religious requirement. I was told it was a religious, as a Muslim woman, I have to undergo FGM to be pure, to be Muslim. That was the narrative that I had. But nowadays, young girls are hearing the other version. We are going into the communities to teach them about the other version of FGM.
Okay, let me go to the first one, but I think you're making it very clear. So because the best way to convince an imam that this practice is not acceptable is to have another imam or another religious person, because then they can speak the same language. And that other religious or other imam can say, look, this does not exist in the Quran. So that is the kind of thing you're doing, you know, mobilizing to deal with those on the opposition who claim religion as required. So to combat them, you're going to need people of the same background, of the same education to deal with them. And that's it. I think that would be obviously far more effective than anyone else to do so, which is right. Now going, are you successful in mobilizing religious individuals to be able to join your movement, to join an organization in order to argue against the claim that this is what Islam require? Are you able to mobilize such individuals who can actually make that argument?
Yes, we are. At the beginning, I think since we had the threat to repeal the law started back in August, a lot of religious leaders took a step back because of the fear of backlash when you speak up. So for a few months, we struggled to have any religious leaders coming out to join us. But over the past 3-4 months, when things really intensified, some religious leaders bravely came out and denounced what the other religious leaders were saying. We organized a conference, a religious conference on FGM, where we invited religious leaders and clerks from Egypt to come also to join our religious leaders to explain that FGM wasn't a religious obligation on families. So we've been doing a lot of that. We've been also going on TV and radio programs so that we spread out that message as well. Because what we found was that the other side, the religious leaders, were going to the mosque, especially during Friday prayers, and using the time for preaching and the qurba to actually encourage the practice of FGM, and also reinforcing the message that FGM was a religious obligation. So to counter that, we started bringing the other religious leaders who were supporting us to also come out and to use social media and TV programs also to spread out, but also for them to use their mosque to also clarify that FGM wasn't a religious obligation.
And it's part of their work as well to enlist other imams. That is, imam now who is convinced that this is the wrong practice. Are they in a position also, have you been asked to mobilize other imams so that this force of imams put together? Do you see that happening, that imams are mobilizing other imams to join them in the campaign against this practice?
In fact, what we are seeing is that it's the other side, the people that are promoting and supporting FGM, they're the ones that are actually engaging, targeting, especially young men in the madrasas, going into these Arabic schools and using those spaces to bring them to join the fight to continue FGM. And one of the weapons that they use is to say that people who are advocating against FGM are westernized and influenced by Western ideologies, and that also we are anti-Islam, and that is the narrative that they've managed to spread in the country, which is going back to your earlier question, is what is causing a lot of trouble for us. It's one of our biggest challenge, because they've made that narrative that we are influenced by the West to actually fight Islam. So they have that power.
Yeah. So you're saying, you know, they go to the school, they try to influence young men to believe in the same thing. So how are you encountering that in the schools? Are you making an effort to also penetrate the schools and again try to demonstrate or to show, to convince young men that this is the wrong practice and it is not good for them, just as it is bad for the women themselves? Are you making an effort within the educational system, in schools themselves?
Unfortunately, not within school. And this has actually got me thinking back to your first question about the challenges at the government level. Whilst the government hasn't directly stopped anybody, but those institutionalized and structural challenges exist, whereas we will not be allowed to go into school because it will be seen as we are giving, you know, information that some parents will not appreciate. So instead of going into schools, what we do, we target communities, and we have a project that is called like positive masculinity. So in encouraging positive masculinity, we work with young men to bring them on our side so that they see FGM. As you said, it's not just a woman's issue. It's not just the survivor's issue. It should be a whole community issue. Men should care, because it's men who are also the fathers and the uncles, and they are actually the people who make decisions within the household as to what happened to those girls. But also they are the husbands of these women who endure pain during sexual intercourse. So they should also care. So as in a part of our outreach activities, we target men and boys at the community level to engage them and to have these meaningful conversations and to have them as our allies in the fight against FGM.
And how successful are you? I mean, these men specifically, those who are married for that matter, and they experience difficulties and when they have sexual interaction. Obviously, yes. The women feels the pain, and given that, you know, sexuality obviously provides some pleasure, obviously, and if the woman is feeling pain, so the man obviously is affected by that. Do they understand that if they end this practice, marriages will be happier, relationship between men and women will be better. Do they understand that? Are they conceding? I mean, how successful are you? This is my question, really. How successful are you with a young man to being convinced that this is not just bad for the women, but it is also for them? Once you know, how successful are you in that regard?
I think we, in my measure, like my indicators for success, is that we've been successful because for the first time, we are seeing men coming out and sharing experiences of, for example, the first night they were given their bride after getting married, how they couldn't have sexual intercourse because the girl or the woman is infibulated. That is when the FGM is actually, the woman is stitched closed completely. Men have come out to share the horror that happened. So by doing that, we are breaking the culture of silence. We are getting men involved, whereas the conversation around FGM was just with women telling their stories. We've been able to bring men, and we know that that is a big deal in our communities, where there is a huge culture of silence around FGM, especially when it comes to men. So men have been coming out and speaking, and we've had men also taking stance and sharing that for them, they've decided that because of the experience and now understanding how FGM affects women, they've decided to take a stance that their future daughters or the daughters they have will not be caught. And I think that is very instrumental, and it's a huge milestone, because FGM can be ended in a generation. If you do not cut your daughter, there is 98% chances that she's not going to cut her daughter in the future. And that is how we can end FGM. So part of the successes that we have had is that breaking the culture of silence, but also men coming out and saying that they will not allow for their daughters to undergo FGM.
And I think that is extremely important. That is, women advocacy is important, necessary, need to take place. But women and men actually make the same advocacy, I think their influences are probably much greater, because it is men who ordain that to begin with. It is men who feel that they want to really prevent women from enjoying sexuality in every which way they can. I mean, this is a chauvinistic approach by men, and they want to leave for themselves the pleasure that they want to get out of sexuality, and then preventing the women from having the same experiences. So engaging men in this practice, in preventing, in advocacy against the FGM, I think it's very, very important. You also mentioned effort within the community, that is awareness, to break the silence. What sort of method are you using to get into the communities in order to change minds and hearts there?
So I'll give you an example. So when I had FGM done to me when I was 8 years old, and I remember when I was caught, I was told that on that same day, I was told that if I spoke about what happened to me with anybody, that old woman will come back and cut me again. So, and I know that is what happens to girls when they are caught. You are threatened. So there's a lot of mystery around FGM, and that is how this practice also has been entrenched, and women have been silenced about what happened to them and their bodies. So breaking that culture of silence, allowing women to speak up and to say what happened to me is wrong and is unacceptable, and also how it affects them, their bodies, their mental health, and their relationships, is important for us to voice this out. So to end FGM, it's very important to give women that voices and that agency by breaking that culture of silence that has been perpetuated over many years to silence women's experiences of this harmful practice. So one of the things we do when we go into communities, we know that, for example, in our communities, when you bring men and women together, usually the women will not share their experiences or speak. We usually organize women-only safe spaces, women-only listening circles, to provide a space for women to share their experiences and learn together how FGM has affected them. As I said earlier, you will find that a lot of women who have had FGM do not actually realize the implications because they do not connect those experiences with FGM. So when we create these safe spaces, we are able to bring a doctor or a gynecologist who is able to talk to women about the women's reproductive health, about their body, and makes the connections with them. And we found that that has been really successful because it really lights the bulb for women to realize that, oh, I am actually not having sexual pleasure because my clitoris was removed or because I am stitched. The reason my periods are not flowing properly is because I am closed inside and there is no way for my period to come out. So we make these connections. And when once women get that, it helps them to make that informed choice about what happens to their daughters, but also how to speak about FGM and its implications within their household level. We also create the same safe spaces for younger women or young girls to also start breaking that culture of silence, but also to empower them with knowledge about their bodies so that they know how FGM impacts them, but also to anticipate what do you expect as a survivor of FGM or as a victim? What do you expect as a woman growing up? And these are things that, for instance, in my generation, we didn't have access. So I didn't understand being a survivor, what that means or how the practice that was performed on me affects me and my womanhood.
I see. Now, do you see, I think this is admirable. Do you see, for example, women themselves before they were cut? I mean, obviously, those are being cut and they're young. They don't wait until the girl is 15 or 16 or 18.
Mm-hmm.
They do so probably before the age of 7 or 8. Am I right to assume that? That most of women who are subjected to this are much very young, so they cannot resist.
Yeah.
And so you're having now a group of women who've been cut who are actually now joining the organization and talking to another young woman. Now, who they can talk to? Because are they talking to the little girls? Who are they going to talk to prevent this from further spreading? Are they able to talk to parents who have girls who have not been cut, for example, as yet, and try to prevent them from practicing this terrible thing? Are you able to get women with girls, that is women that who have daughters who have not been cut, to try to convince the mothers that this is terrible practice and they are inflicting unacceptable, terrible pain on their daughters? Have you been able to mobilize mothers for that matter, that have girls that still been spared the FGM?
Yes, and you know, you've got a great point there, because once FGM is performed on an individual, on a girl, you can't reverse it. And also, as you say, in the Gambia, for example, FGM happens to girls when they're very little. In fact, now it's changing. During my time, I had mine done. The average age was 5 to 8. But now we are seeing that they're even doing it to babies, 1 week old, 1 month old. So that's changing. So the issue of consent and decision cannot be on the child. So it is important that we target parents. So one of the initiatives that we've introduced is to talk to young couple, people who've just been married, and start having those conversations when you have your daughter, and start exposing them to that information, reminding them that FGM is illegal, but also giving them information about how FGM is harmful to the girl child and it has no benefit on them. And I think that is the way of ending FGM, by the generation, the future generation, by the mothers and the fathers making that informed decision that they will not cut their kids. Because there is no point saying to little girls that you're going to educate them about FGM, because they don't know when it's going to happen to them, and they don't have the ways. We don't even have ways of reporting where you would say that the child is educated, that if they suspect they're being, and because FGM is a one off time, it's not like it's prepared for. You don't call. We don't have like a social service where you could call and ask for assistance. So they really, to break through that is by talking to parents, so that they take that informed choice not to cut their daughters.
So in this particular case, suppose those who are getting married and the wife it's been eradicated. I'm sure you came experience this. So you are talking now to the couple, young couple, just got married, but the wife, the bride or the women just been cut. And are you able now to talk to this couple where the mother, the would-be mother, the future mother has already been cut to convince the mother and her husband that how to prevent that from happening? What kind of reception are you getting from these mothers who've been already cut, or from these mothers, probably very few for that matter, that have not been cut? Do you see the difference in the conversation between you and these young couples?
Yes, I think that the complexity that we encounter in that is also shows the complexity of FGM itself. Often when you speak to those couple, they may say to you that actually we don't want to cut our daughter, but that decision lies in my mother-in-law. Like the woman would say, it depends what my mother-in-law wants. So as much as you engage this young couple, the autonomy, the decision as to what happened, that influence can also come from the mother-in-law. And this is why it's always important in each household, you need to determine who controls the power. The sad reality of FGM, even though it is done to please men, the whole procedure, the whole act is carried out by women. It is the mother, the aunties, the grandmothers that come together to take this process. So that is the complexity of FGM.
Yeah, and the husband, I mean, the young man, are they taking stand? I mean, are you convincing those young men who are just getting married? Are you telling them, you know, you need to resist that and not allow this either your mother or your mother-in-law to have a say on this, because you are the man and it is should be your decision? Are you encountering men who are saying, yeah, we're willing to fight my mother, my grandmother, or my aunt to prevent, you know, to prevent them from having this practice done to my wife?
Yes, I'll give you an example, and this is a family that I encountered and spoke to. The man, when he got married to the wife, she had FGM and she was sealed completely, and she told of the trauma that she went through, the lady went through, but also for the husband as well, seeing what his wife went through. He decided that from that day he would never cut his. If he had a daughter, he had three daughters, and he stood firm and said that that would never happen to his daughters. And I still remember this, he talking about this and being so emotional. And there was a time he traveled and his mother took all three daughters and cut them all and sealed them and did exactly what happened to his wife. Even though he had taken that stance that he never, and he told me about the difficulties at that point. What would he do? Would he take his mother to police? And he knew if he did that, he would be ostracized by his community. So that those are the kind of challenges that we have in the fight to end FGM.
Right. Now, the government passed the law, to my understanding, about that prohibiting this practice. And but the practice continues because, as you mentioned earlier, it's a tradition, it's a culture. Now, when the government, suppose somebody complained to the government and say, this is the law, and somebody need to enforce the law, is the government trying any time, any place to enforce the law, to punish those who are actually continuing with this terrible practice?
Sadly, the experience we've had is that the law isn't being enforced. We had the law, but from 2015 to mid last year, we only had one, I think, successful conviction. So that shows you how little the law was being implemented. And since August last year, from my experience, we've had cases that we've reported to the police of FGM, and the police have told us directly that they were not going to intervene on FGM cases, even though the law is still there. So that makes our work really difficult, because now we have a law, we go to the communities and inform them of the law. And when a girl is caught and that case is reported, the police are telling us they're not doing anything. And that is a big letdown from the state of not taking responsibility of the implementation of these laws.
So let us assume for a moment, Gambia obviously is not a rich country and depend on aid coming from other countries. Which are the countries that provide financial aid to Gambia? For example,
we have funding from EU.
From where?
From the EU, from the US.
The EU. Okay. The EU, the UN. But let us talk about the EU. The UN is a little bit more cumbersome in terms of passing any resolution or putting any pressure on this country or other country. Usually they haven't been successful, but the EU is a different story. So the EU is providing aid. Is there any campaign going to go to those countries that are providing this aid and say to them, why don't you condition the aid, in part, condition your financial aid that the government, if they want to continue to receive this aid, they need to enforce their own law. Is there such a campaign? Is there such an effort being made?
Absolutely. We civil society organizations, we are coming together and actually talking to these funders and donors and diplomatic community to say that Gambia is not an island. We are part of the international community. We have signed treaties like the CEDAW, the CRC, but also at the regional level, at the African Union level, we've signed treaties that prohibits female genital mutilation. So we have a responsibility and an obligation to those international treaties to maintain this law and also to implement it. So we are talking to donors and saying that they must put pressure on the government and there must be repercussions if they are not protecting women's rights, because women's rights are human rights. So they cannot be going as a country. And as you know, our history, we went through a 22 years of dictatorship, which had widespread human rights violations. We were able to successfully get rid of a dictator and went through a transitional justice process where we had a truth commission and we are rebuilding our human rights as a country. And the whole world is watching us and seeing little Gambia as a country that is successfully going through this phase. So it's the irony. And also it's very embarrassing that we will be going through that process. At the same time, we want to take away rights and protections of women.
I see. So let me give you another question. Are you getting any kind of financial support from, say, Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, like United Arab Emirates, those countries, the rich oil countries? Are you getting any financial support from them?
Well, interestingly, the Gambia is part of the OIC. And this year we are hosting the annual OIC conference in the Gambia. So in a few weeks' time, heads of states from across the Islamic countries will be in the Gambia for the summit, the OIC summit. So, and I believe that, I don't know to what extent, but the OIC, I know for definite, are supporting the Gambia a lot. And we are looking at programming that and projects that are that would contribute to the development of the country. So right. Yes, that's not a great angle, and I hope they're also paying attention to these issues that are happening.
Right, because I think this is very important. Now, there is the private campaign that you have within the community itself. You have the campaign, the effort to mobilize imams, other religious leaders, in order to influence their counterpart, their peers, and convince them that this is a terrible practice. So you're doing this. The question now is, because there's the public awareness, are you successful in creating public awareness, for example, through the media, through social media, through television? Do you have access to this kind of public media in order to create more exposure to this whole issue on a more national scale? Is any such a thing happening? Are you able to do that? Are you going to try to make an effort in that regard?
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, not so much on TV, because a lot of our civil society organizations don't have the financial support. We don't have that structure and support to be and resources to be able to implement such activities. However, we take advantage of social media like Facebook, WhatsApp, audios, and Twitter, just to continue amplifying our advocacy, but also bringing it to the international community. Ideally, if we had access to resources where we would be able to amplify our advocacy and awareness raising, we would target community radios more, because we know that in most part of rural communities, that's where they get their source of information, but also TV platforms and talk shows, so that we can also talk on the FGM issue, but also bring the different debates on the table, so that communities are given that information on FGM and what is happening.
Is there a possibility, I think this is very important, that and also is a possibility that the government, for example, will appoint a woman like a minister of sort, who has been cut or perhaps not, who actually become the voice for the government, but for women. Yes. Is there such a thing? The government has that kind of a minister, a woman who is actually is advocating for ending this practice?
Yeah, we actually have a minister of gender who was a big FGM advocate. She worked for many years advocating against FGM. Unfortunately, since this conversation started, the government decided to take a quiet stance. They didn't issue a statement, they didn't come out, they didn't say anything, including the Ministry of Gender, who herself is not only a CS survivor, but she also worked on FGM for many, many years. So as a civil society, and we were very much let down by that, because we expected the government to take a stance. We expected the ministry that deals with women's affairs and children's affairs to stand up and speak up against this harmful traditional practice, which they didn't all these months until a couple of weeks ago. They issued a very, a statement, but that was not even very strong. So, but one thing that I want to highlight, that FGM is a political issue.
Yes. Yeah.
For many politicians, including the government, they believe that if they speak against the practice, that will cost them votes. So as I keep saying, it is women's bodies are being used as a political battlefield. And, right. And this is why even our National Assembly members, when the bill came there, a lot of them said that if they voted not to repeal the law, they will not be revoted to come back as MPs during the next elections. So because of that, they took a stance not to, this is why it ended up at the committee stage. So right. In short, that is the reality. It's a political issue and politicians are not talking about
it. And, obviously this will take years to change, because we're talking about politics and the politicians and, in order for them to be elected, they don't want to go against the current, the social current, which is still in favor of FGM. My question, or final question I want to ask you, if you were to ask for help, any kind of help, be that financial, be that, political support, financial support, who do you turn to? And who would be the most important source in order to help you, maybe sources? To help you, that is, what kind of appeal are you making to, other than to your communities, other than to the imams and others? Are you appealing to the international community? Is any officials or members or your own community that are against FGM actually outside talking about, say, United Nations, a forum, in any other forum, to bring this issue to light?
Yes, for us at the moment, we have, one of the short-term intervention, our appeal is to make sure that our government maintains the law, because we do need a legal framework that safeguards girls. So we do want the international community to also put pressure and remind our government of their responsibility and obligations to uphold the rights of women and girls. But we also want to, for me, when I look at FGM, we cannot end FGM without ending the broader gender inequality. So for example, if we had better women representation in politics, in cabinet, at the National Assembly, we would have had more women deciding on what happened to women and their bodies. It was sad during the second reading of the bill, we had a house that was full of men who were talking about what should happen to women and girls' bodies. That was great. They had the narrative, they had the control, because we don't have adequate representation at the National Assembly. But also reaching out to communities, we cannot end FGM or gender-based violence without mobilizing resources and going out into the communities and educating them and countering this narrative, or also bringing the other, like for instance, other religious leaders on our side. We need resources to be able to reach out. And that is one of our biggest challenge as organizations that are fighting against not just female genital mutilation, but gender inequality in general.
And are you getting this kind of financial support, say, from the EU just for the purpose or in order to promote your cause?
Not on the FGM issue yet. We are pledging, we are writing proposals, we are looking for people who would like to support organizations or individuals that have any support that they think could come to us. But at the moment, it's been a big constraint. We've not had resources to be able to counter this fight. And women-led organizations particularly are at even more disadvantaged as civil society organizations, because we lack those resources and structures to be able to counter this fight. And for us, we know that it is so important that we fight to maintain this law, because if we lose this battle, if the FGM law gets repealed, we are setting a precedent, and other countries around the region that are looking at enforcing laws or enacting laws against female genital mutilation will find it difficult to get that, because they will use Gambia as an example. But we also have the issue of cross-border cutting. Gambia is a hub. The other regions, the other countries are around us, even if they have a law against FGM, if FGM is it's not if it's if the law is repealed here, they could travel here and have their girls cut. So we have those challenges.
Yeah, I just final question, because this is very important in terms of if there's any of this financial aid is coming to you, is it allowed to legally to get money from the outside to support your cause?
Yes, absolutely. We've been implementing projects, and we have the processes and structures to have to receive funding both locally and internationally to implement.
And if somebody wants to send you this money, how do they go about it? Who do they send it to?
Usually we would speak to the person or the organization, and if they require us to submit a proposal, we do, and then we have a whole transaction. We have our organization has an account and accounting structures that we would follow to be able to facilitate that.
I see. All right. You know, I think what you're doing is amazing, extremely, extremely important cause what you're doing. I deal with many human rights issues, and in my Facebook, almost every week, sometimes daily, we talk about human rights issue, specifically also related to women, child labor, mm-hmm. and all of that, and we will continue to do our best. In order to promote, in particular, after this conversation, what's going on in Gambia, and however little help that might provide, it still is better than nothing. I want to thank you so much for taking the time, and we look forward to another conversation, hopefully sometime soon.
Thank you. I am really honored that you see this as a human rights issue, and that's what it should be treated as. Many people look at FGM as a culture and a traditional issue and treat it differently. But I appreciate you pointing out that FGM is a violation of the rights of women and their dignity and integrity, and it should be treated as a human rights issue. And thank you so much.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. As a matter of fact, only a few days ago, we have several posts on this issue, even before I knew I'm going to talk to you. So we will continue our effort. And again, thank you so much and all the very best to you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode on the issues. You can find this podcast on my SoundCloud page and stay tuned to my social media accounts for the latest analysis and announcements.